Welcome to Intelligent Medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we're going to cover an issue that is very timely. This weekend, we learned of the tragic death of Philip Seymour Hoffman, and it was quite a shock. I was actually standing in line at the Jewish Museum. It was the last day of the Chagall exhibit, and I was standing around waiting because it was a long line, and I looked at my cell phone, and I saw the news, and people online started talking about it. They were so shocked to hear the death of this fabulous actor that we've enjoyed seeing so much in movies. And to bring us a little perspective on this story, the facts, of course, are just emerging about the circumstances of his death. I've invited the chief executive officer of Origin Recovery Centers. This is a place where people go for comprehensive addiction treatment. He is Benjamin Levinson, and he is the co-founder of Origins Recovery Centers. Benjamin has personal experience with recovery from chronic addiction, so he's been there, and he offers a unique perspective on the addiction problem, but now he's totally dedicated to combating addiction. He speaks frequently to the public on addiction treatment issues, and he has a lot to say about the current tragic circumstances of the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman. So without further ado, let's introduce our guest, Benjamin Levinson. Ben, it's a pleasure having you here on Intelligent Medicine.
It's a real privilege to get to spend time with you and your listeners, Dr. Hoffman. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Okay, so the circumstances are kind of murky, but it was pretty clear that there was heroin in the apartment, that Philip Seymour Hoffman literally had a needle in his arm. So we don't have to surmise about the cause of death. What is less clear but is beginning to emerge is a fact pattern that suggests that it wasn't just heroin, that there were other prescription drugs in the apartment or that Philip Seymour Hoffman had been using. You know, from your personal experience working with addicts and from your own individual experience, could you shed some light on the circumstances of this?
Yeah, I'd love to. First of all, it's a real tragic event. Any time anybody passes away, particularly behind what is a treatable illness, getting sober for any addict is really a bear. But recovery for addicts who have fame and success is often even more challenging. A distorted sense of self-importance kind of combined with applause and paparazzi and money really put jet engines on addiction and make it particularly difficult to maintain the humble, kind of grounded spirit of selflessness that's necessary for sustained recovery. Addicts, Doc, normally they're notorious for trying to treat their internal problems with external solutions, whether that's attention or sex or money or drugs or sick relationships, and these things, you know, are shoved at celebrities in literally supersized proportions. Interestingly, with Hoffman, you know, he reported having 23 years of recovery, and somewhere along the way, he stopped doing what he needed to do to manage the chronic illness of addiction, and this internal discomfort. Persisted long enough in him that addicted thinking took over and essentially made sense out of or rationalized, you know, feeling better with abuse.
Well, you know, you brought up several themes here. And actually, I had a patient in the office this morning who herself is a recovering addict. And she said that it is not an uncommon scenario for people to be clean and sober for a long period of time. They're okay. They're doing the right thing. But then a circumstance comes along where they develop a medical problem. And so often we deal with pain problems with, of course, pain medication. It's not uncommon for a guy 46 to have a back problem, or, you know, we don't even know what he was being treated for. But doctors have a pretty light hand with prescribing medications like Vicodin for pain and so on. And what she has said is that this can sometimes be a gateway towards relapse, because once you rekindle the yen for a nice oblivion with a pain medication, that it's pretty easy to go back to more powerful stuff. Do you think that's maybe a factor in this situation?
Without question, and you're spot on. I mean, ASAM defines a chronic disease of brain reward, motivation, memory, and the related circuitry. And I think it's a really important point that you draw, that the larger context, which is that we're really in the midst of a prescription opiate epidemic. Once an addict, always an addict, is our professional experience and what the data suggests. And I, what I mean when I say that is that once we've struggled with substance dependence, there's really no safe way to take intoxicants or substances that act kind of on the reward circuitry. It's like chronic diabetes, but with an insidious mental twist. I mean, diabetics learn to manage their illness daily, but they never wake up, you know, one morning questioning whether they have diabetes. And addicts do. Those with long-term sobriety, who relapse, like Hoffman did, often will die with their first use, and many within a few months. Very few who relapse after decades of sobriety are able to achieve sustainable recovery again.
I mean, and why is that? Why is that? Because, you know, this is actually, it's almost like a familiar movie trope about addiction, is that, you know, the people struggle with addiction, then they get off, and then somehow they're having a bad day, they meet the dealer crooks their finger at them, gives them a packet of whatever, heroin, says it's great stuff, and all of a sudden, the same stuff that they used to take day in and day out years before, it kills them. So what's up with that?
Well, absolutely. A couple of things. One is that they'll resume the quantities and doses that they were taking at the height of their addiction.
So there's tolerance is involved. Tolerance can be part of this.
They don't have the tolerance that they had developed at that time. And so that's often fatal. But the second thing is that, you know, addiction is progressive. And essentially the way we talk about it with our patients is the entire time that somebody's sober, their addiction is actually kind of getting worse, and so activated. The addiction is in an advanced or as advanced of a state as it would have been had they been using the entire time they were sober.
Hmm. That's an interesting concept. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So all of that taken, I mean, together with kind of the larger picture around, you know, the opiate epidemic. I mean, Americans comprise 4.6% of the global population. However, we consume 80% of the world's opioids. We have, as you mentioned, pretty loose prescribing habits, and you know, some 600,000 U.S. physicians are writing orders that lead to Americans consuming. You mentioned Vicodin. We consume 99% of the world's hydrocodone, according to the CDC. You know, that's enough dope each year to medicate every single American man, woman, and child with 5 milligrams every 4 hours for a solid month.
That'd get the average American pretty stoned.
Indeed. So it's a major problem, and we kind of combine that, I think, with the stigma and just this, I think, kind of social tendency to ignore. Only about 2.3 million were able to access care last year.
So it's a much ignored problem. So, you know, you actually, in an email that in the past couple of weeks, New York has reported 5 deaths, Pittsburgh and Maryland have recorded 22 deaths. And, so what's up with that? Is the heroin, stronger? Is it laced with something else? What accounts for these numbers?
Yeah, it's a huge problem. As opiate users are developing tolerance for the prescriptions or the prescription ends, they begin to look for replacement, whether it's cheaper, stronger, and often that replacement is heroin. This illicit substance is not regulated. Obviously, its purity and composition will vary greatly from batch to batch even. So along the supply chain for heroin, people modify it to increase their profits, and they do that by creating more weight or adding filler to it. But in order to counterbalance the strength of it, they'll back add things like fentanyl or other strength.
Fentanyl? What is fentanyl?
Fentanyl is a super powerful opiate. It's about 100 times more potent than morphine. And was originally primarily used for palliative care.
For cancer patients. I mean, it's the cancer pain.
Exactly.
They give you a fentanyl patch. But they give it to you as a patch. They don't inject it, because injecting fentanyl, wow, that's really going to go to your brain fast.
Absolutely. So these you know, along the supply chain, they'll modify the contents of the heroin is what they're getting. In an addicted mindset, it's like, I'm so uncomfortable inside. I'm coming apart, and really, I'll do anything to make it go away. And that includes, you know, ingesting substances of, you know, no known origin.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, frankly, I mean, we're concerned about the food that we eat, the water that we drink. Everybody's very fastidious about that. We want to make sure that, you know, if we get a prescription drug, that it's been inspected by the FDA. But these folks, these otherwise intelligent, you know, well-off individuals will shoot unknown substances directly into their veins, and within seconds it goes directly to their heart and brain. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, and addiction isn't logical.
Yeah.
And that's why when we talk about addiction, we really try to convey to non-addicts a deeper understanding of what's happening with these individuals. You know, the real addict, Doc, does not have a drug problem. The real addict has a drug solution. It's what they're using to get okay inside.
Mm-hmm.
And others can relate to this in terms of using all kinds of external stimuli to kind of change the way they feel. I mean, as a culture, we use food and meds and shopping and pot and alcohol and sex and social media, celebrity worship. We use a lot of things to kind of change the way we feel. And addicts in particular have kind of this default discomfort inside. And so this is why abstinence alone doesn't treat addiction, because we're asking them to kind of stop breathing in effect. And so what we have to do, and what we do at Origins, is we help our patients, you know, set down the non-viable solution called drugs and alcohol. But as importantly, pick up an alternative solution in order to get okay inside. Because when our patients are okay inside, i.e. in recovery versus abstinence, there's nothing to fix. And they therefore don't, as Hoffman did, make sense out of the unthinkable. That's kind of a lay way to kind of express what is going on in the addicted person. So it's they're not partying at all. This is about just getting okay inside, even if for a minute.
Just maintenance, you know, of a steady state without going into a state of distress. So how do you fill the void? You know, you say, well, abstinence isn't it, that you need to be in active recovery. Active recovery means what? Spirituality, psychology, going to meetings, you know, having a menu of really positive experiences in your life. I mean, what are the ingredients for that?
Really, all of the above. I mean, fundamentally, what we know is that addiction never really exists in a vacuum. And so our treatment approaches involve really strong and lengthy assessments of everything that's going on with a person. And it could be that they have coexisting psychological disorders that they're contending with along with addiction. But in any event, is a simultaneous and integrated approach to treating kind of the constellation of problems that a person has. How does that translate into kind of everyday life? Certainly for many, you know, attending meetings, engaging in what many call spiritual activity, which could be some form of prayer, not sp- specifically religious, but whatever that looks like for that person. Certainly the age-old practice of meditation, we know, particularly recently, has strong impacts on the brain, and really changing the brain. And interestingly, you know, some selfless activity, finding ways to be of service to those who potentially are less fortunate. So if addiction is, you know, kind of has the hallmark of selfishness, one of the anti-venoms is certainly to kind of get out of ourselves and go help somebody else. But certainly a combination of that along with appropriate clinical interventions, with evidence-based practices, and, you know, resolving co-occurring non-psychiatric medical issues that may be hypertension and gout and all the things that sometimes come along with someone who's been abusing substances. So this is why, you know, really multidisciplinary treatment is so important, and in context with kind of the reality, that's not where the funding is. You know, we've criminalized a disease, many argue, and you know, out of the billions we spend on it, you know, a couple of percent only go to prevention and treatment. The rest go to incarceration, which, gosh, I wish it worked. If pain and punishment worked, addicts would have stopped a long time ago, because they've certainly been in a lot of pain. So we're really strong advocates for rethinking the way we fund addiction treatment and the way we address this on a social scale, by really reallocating dollars to treatment and prevention,
as opposed to criminalizing it. But recently there have been lots of initiatives to legalize marijuana, and it's highly controversial. You know, some people say, look, it's a harmless recreational drug, and, you know, people drink and they manage it. And yet some people say that it's a gateway drug. It's opening up the floodgates to a tide of addiction to more powerful illicit drugs or prescription drugs. Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, what I have is experience with this in terms of seeing just a rash of patients who have absolutely devastated their lives and the lives of their families with chronic marijuana use and abuse. It's you know, it's we see it frequently.
So, in other words, you have people coming to your center, the Origins Recovery Centers, and they're not addicted to pills, and they're not addicted to heroin, and they're not snorting coke or smoking crack. They're just messing up their entire lives and relationships by smoking pot with pot dependency?
Absolutely. And brain and brain health and you know, from a neurochemical standpoint, I mean, we see protracted periods of post-acute withdrawal syndrome, including severe anxiety, maladjustment in that regard. You know, but we see the kind of the pre-recovery consequences, where they're unable to show up emotionally in their relationships, unable to manage their finances, potential legal issues. I mean, all of the criteria that we look for around other substances of abuse, we see in chronic pot addiction. So it's kind of the untold part of the story. We're on the receiving end of everybody who you know, went after the marijuana thinking that, hey, it's no worse than alcohol, I can do this and you know, I'll be fine, and you know, they weren't fine, and they end up devastated and in our care. The good news is, you know, while addiction doesn't discriminate across socioeconomic bounds, recovery doesn't either, and we see patients have, you know, wonderful, abundant lives. These are super creative, brilliant people, professors from great universities. I see, I mean, you know, attorneys, physicians, college kids, all types, across all lines. It's a real privilege to get to work with such special people and to see them have phenomenal lives in recovery.
Well, our case in point, Philip Seymour Hoffman, certainly exemplified that. But you talk about a subset of addiction, which is celebrity addiction. And in fact, there have been recent reality shows like Celebrity Rehab that almost makes it sound like an oxymoron, because, you know, that lifestyle, you know, all the attention, perhaps all the enablers sometimes that surround you in the show business world, you know, maybe it's not so good. Maybe it puts you at high risk.
It does. I mean, and you know, I've had the opportunity to work with folks who profession involved, you know, them having celebrity status, who also struggled with addiction. And as I mentioned, I mean, they're almost inextricable from it. And you have it spot on, the kind of constellation of people that surround that person tend to really enable them all the way to the grave. And then you layer in the, you know, kind of the attention and the better thanism, and all of those things that literally fuel the ego, which in turn fuels addiction, make it just tremendously difficult for these folks to get back to kind of ground level. It's a real challenge for them, and also the part that this is disturbing is really for every, you know, for every celebrity that overdoses, there's 75 to 100 non-celebrities that died that day too. For every celebrity that makes it into the media with their drug addiction and abuse and recovery, there are, you know, millions of us suffering in silence below the headline. And you know, it's a real epidemic in our country. I hate that it requires the loss of someone such a great talent like Hoffman to stir the conversation. But I'm really grateful for professionals like you who take the opportunity to bring up the topic again, because it needs attention. It's not just the 23 million Americans who suffer from addiction, but it's on average the three family members who are struggling with codependency around them. I mean, we're talking about over 100 million people who are affected, either within their family or
yeah. It's a terrible tragedy, not just for the person, but it affects all the people in their lives. And it's very devastating. The social consequences are enormous.
So we, you know, and that's the other piece, is that for listeners to know that if they are wrestling with the effects of loving or being friends with someone who has addiction, that it's important for them to kind of take stock of how this is this affecting me. When we treat an individual, we really are treating the entire family system. And effective treatment means treating the whole family. And whether they want to admit it or not, they're highly affected. And I would encourage, you know, your listeners to go read a little bit more about codependency, and what that involves. I've seen entire families lose themselves to addiction, even though the majority of them aren't, you know, directly suffering, from it. It devastatingly rearranges kind of the dynamics within the family system to essentially ensure its own existence. And so what feels loving to a family member, like bailing their addicted loved one out of jail or making sure she has rent money to pay the rent, what feels loving is in fact the very last thing that addict needs, kind of in order to realize the severity of their situation. And interestingly, what feels unloving, you know, potentially drawing some boundaries and saying, look, I can't be in your life in this way, is often the very thing that person needs to get the message that the way they're living is not okay, and nobody's going to participate in the death march anymore.
So-called tough love.
Tough love, so to speak. Yeah, and reclaiming their own health, because addiction will take their physical and emotional and financial and spiritual territories away from them, the family members I'm talking about. And they literally become consumed, driving by bars, calling hospitals, calling jails, and they lose themselves in the process. And so we know that the best thing a family member can do for their addicted loved one is not try to manage their addiction, but it's actually to get into recovery themselves. And there are lots of ways to do that, including the wonderful Al-Anon program.
Al-Anon, right. Mm-hmm.
are out there. Yes, yeah, for these folks too.
For the relatives, not the person. You know, a lot of people think, well, Al-Anon, that's for alcohol addiction. No, it's actually it's for relatives of people with substance abuse problems. The relatives.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, do you care to share with us your own personal experience? Can that shed light on this? Because you come to this with the experience of addiction, and that's what's, I think, impassioned you to work to combat addiction, but also given you unique personal insights into what it's all about.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Addiction really permeated my family generationally. What we know is that about 50% of folks who end up with substance use disorders are genetically preloaded, and then environmental factors will exacerbate that predisposition. So I have my mom is 20 years sober, and I have a she lost a brother to an overdose, and then in 2001 I lost a brother to an overdose. You know, Doc, I grew up in a great family. My mom was a homemaker, and Dad was a businessman, and a simple town out in West Texas, and I thought, you know, that it was my right to experiment with intoxicants. It's my body, and I'm not hurting anybody. Mm-hmm. I had no ill intention at all.
Well, it's also maybe a little bit of West Texas culture there. You know, we're talking Saturday Night Lights, that whole thing.
Perhaps. But, you know, I really believed that, just like everybody else that I saw, that, yeah, I could experiment with some marijuana and some alcohol, and you know, I'll come out on the other end in my 20s with a master's degree on my wall and, you know, a beautiful wife and a career path. And I'll set the substances down and get on with the meat of life. And, that wasn't the case by the time I was, in college, out on the East Coast, things were not okay. I had, progressed into some harder substances and really started to get caught up in really the kind of the cycle of addiction. I mean, unable to really distinguish the true from the false, kind of lost in the fog of addiction. Made my way back to Texas and eventually reached out for help and ended up in the first of what it would be really 11 more treatment episodes. I sought treatment and received treatment from the finest treatment institutions on the planet. Had the privilege of and the resources to do that. But at the time, and really still, the field treated addiction on almost a strictly acute basis.
Mm-hmm.
And really, when you think about this, nowhere else in medicine do we really try to treat what we know is chronic disease in strictly acute ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not best practices. It doesn't make sense. Yet, with addiction, you'll see this whole culture of this episodic kind of 28-day acute intervention.
Like a detox program.
Yeah.
Rapid, even more rapid detox, because some people say, look, I don't have the time for that. Just check me in over a weekend, put me under general anesthesia, and then I'll emerge on Monday. I'll be able to go back to the corporate boardroom clean and sober.
Right, when we all really know that detox doesn't treat addiction. In fact, if that's all that happens is a person just kind of separates themselves from this quote unquote solution they've been using to get okay inside, the further away they get from that substance, the worse they'll get, which doesn't make sense to the non-addict. But ask any addict if they feel better when they're not using versus when they are. Similarly, I received fantastic clinical and medical attention. But then I was handed just this discharge plan and expected with a 30-day sober brain to manage my own care plan with essentially the same brain and the same thinking that got me to treatment, you know, not clear. And this process repeated over and over again, and really drove me into the field of addiction treatment, where I'm just very passionate about chronic based systems of care, continuums of care that are multi-staged, that are lengthy, and that take a former chronic based approach to managing what we know as a chronic illness. The other thing that impacted me along my journey was this. In between, I was exposed to some pretty strong 12-step meetings and messages, mm-hmm. and I would roll back into treatment, and there was this kind of disproportionate relationship between clinical and medical care, and what, for lack of a better word, I'll call spiritual care.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew, because of my 12-step exposure, that this was important.
So you're a big believer in the 12-step approach, because there's a body of thought within addiction that 12-step is, you know, that's for some people, but other people could do fine, and they even advocate what's sometimes called the harm reduction model, where you really reduce or curtail most of your use of opiates and alcohol, but occasionally here and there you'll be okay. And that they say these 12-step people are like fanatics; they're on this jihad against substances, and it's not necessary for some people. That's what they're saying.
Yeah, I understand that, and certainly there, domain of recovery has a monopoly. There are people who find and experience recovery in so many different ways. And I would never, say that it's, 12-step or the highway.
Right.
That's just where I found my recovery. And so that it influenced me a lot insofar as when I experienced kind of the care equation within treatment centers, there was just this eerie underemphasis, not even on 12-step recovery, just on spiritual wellness, just on psycho-spiritual kind of dimension of being human. And so that struck me, and until I was a professional, I didn't really understand why that was the case, and subsequently I've learned very clearly that, number one, spiritual care is difficult to measure, but as importantly, it's impossible to get reimbursed for. Because of that, it's over the last 25 years been really driven out of the treatment calculus.
Mm-hmm.
So we've worked real hard here to really reproportion kind of those three care components: medical, clinical, and spiritual. There is no silver bullet. It's about being able to individualize multidisciplinary care for each individual patient, and it's about being able to do that over a continuum of care that's appropriate at each stage, and long enough to incubate the neuroplasticity and the change that needs to happen there, the emotional resolution around trauma, which is a very important piece in the addiction process, and other coexisting disorders that could be anything from anxiety disorders to mood and even personality disorders.
Well, I come to this field as a medical nutritionist, and I'm not here to say that there's a vitamin or a diet that's going to make people stop craving alcohol and opiates. But I was pleased to see that at Origins Recovery Centers, there is a nutrition component. Do you feel that nutrition can play a role in recovery and maintenance of recovery?
It is super important, and the more we learn, the more we realize how important it absolutely is. I mean, gets a nutritional consult, and we're able to meet all gluten-free dietary needs and all kinds, a whole range of dietary needs. But without question, what's been interesting is watching the neuroplasticity department, which is a department that's charged with. I mean, if we really believe addiction centers in the brain, we need to be doing more with the brain, and so that department kind of uses audible and biofeedback devices, mm-hmm. Interventions in the theta range, sensory deprivation chambers, and so some interesting strategies that they use. But they, together with the nutritional group, have done things like eliminate diet sodas from.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
Yeah, from our kind of
excess
our menu,
sugar, that kind of goes to that same addictive part of your brain. I mean, some people self-medicate with sugar.
The amount of brain healing that happens early in the recovery process, and being able to enhance that, to accelerate that, is super important. And it's potentially things like aspartame and other additives that inhibit the neurological healing process, or at least slow it down. So we're really careful in that regard. But yeah, it is critical, as well as physical activity. I mean,
yes,
we ask our patients to, I mean, we, you know, get physical, whether it's in the pool, playing some volleyball, you know, going down to the beach with staff or a mile run, or getting in the weight room with the trainer, and working on their personal training, program. Mm-hmm. It is really, really important. Plus kind of the emotional and the emotional return on that investment is just massive. You know, if we could convince them to exercise consistently throughout their recovery, you know, I'm convinced we could reduce the you know, the psychopharmaceutical you know, aspect of their care.
Right. No disrespect to Philip Seymour Hoffman, but just, you know, from the looks of him, it appears that you know, he certainly did not have a major physical exercise component as part of his program, especially in some of the pictures that we see towards the end.
He had actually gained a pretty significant weight over the last you know, the last 12 months. And in fact, I heard an interview with someone who had one of the last journalists to interview him, and she commented that he was significantly heavier than what he had been previously. And all of that, really, Doc, is consistent with to me, with someone who's in relapse. I mean, just the loss of kind of self-care and letting those practices go, and really turning a lot of that anger and just frustration inward, really consistent with somebody who's in relapse.
You have a unique program at Origins, which is equine therapy. Tell us about that. I guess that's because you're down in Texas, right? So equine therapy is not a reach because you're located down there in South Padre Island.
Yeah, no, it does make sense because we're Texans, but you know, equine based interventions are an evidence based therapeutic intervention, and it was it's used frequently in the course of treatment for children who are struggling with perhaps leukemia or cancer,
or with childhood depression, you know, and autism, attention deficit disorder. I actually have some of the kids that I see in my practice who are undertaking equine therapy.
It's fantastic stuff, and so it's been adapted, and it's becoming more widely used in the course of behavioral healthcare and specifically addiction treatment. These horses, it's not, you know, it's an amazing process where the horses in effect kind of reflect back what the emotional state of the person. These are animals of prey. And that they are very, very sensitive to
they're attuned.
The energy that you bring to them.
Right.
And so if someone's approaching them, they're really kind of in a place of, say, fear or whatever, the horse will exhibit skittishness. And often this is one of the first times that the patient is able to kind of see what's going on inside of themselves. And often, you know, they'll have trust issues with other humans, but we find that they don't have trust issues necessarily with animals. And so it's a great medium for us to use to explore, help our patients kind of explore what's going on inside and start to kind of re-anchor in their emotional landscape, something that they've been running from for a long time. And so in that capacity, it's fun. Also, it's just fun to get outdoors, you know, and go be around animals. These are magnificent animals, and you know, our patients have many, you know, have been really isolated, and certainly not out playing around horses. So it's about kind of returning to humanity and even living in a little bit of that childhood awe of just being around a magnificent animal. But the therapeutic value is tremendous, and we also use it in the course of the family program with the families, and that's always fun and fascinating too. So.
Well, you have a marvelous multidisciplinary program down there at Origins Recovery Centers. So, Ben Levinson, what's the call to action for our listeners? Some of them may be confronted. This issue with Philip Seymour Hoffman, it may be a teachable moment for some of our listeners who are themselves confronting an addiction problem, or perhaps they have a loved one who they fear for their safety because they're concerned that they may be going down that same dangerous path. What can they do?
Yeah, Yeah, well, I think, you know, the answer is to immediately reach out for help. There are a whole host of places to do that, including any reputable treatment center, I think would be willing to help. They can always call us. We spend a lot of time working with families and individuals who we may not end up treating, but helping them get connected with kind of a level of care and the type of help that they need. And we're always happy to do that. It's a real privilege. They could visit our website at www.originsrecovery.com or call us at 1-866-YOU-GET-WELL 24 hours a day. There are people standing by waiting to help.
And just to be clear, your facility is in South Texas, but you actually treat people from all over the country, perhaps all over the world.
Yeah, we treat patients from all 50 states and about 15 countries, and have the privilege of working not just with them, but also with their families. But, you know, I think it's important for people to like you're saying, take advantage of this opportunity and step up and make the call. Super important. The next time somebody gets high could be their last. They can't help themselves. It's incumbent on us to jump in and do that for them.
And to keep in mind that it is truly a dangerous, progressive, and often fatal disease.
Yeah, left unarrested, that's absolutely the case. It does not self-correct. Addiction doesn't just get better on its own. It needs, like any other illness, it needs treatment and consistent disease management. And that's what I'm encouraging everybody to do.
Well, I thank you very much for providing us with additional information and some background on what is certainly a tragic event. The death of Philip Seymour Hoffman. Ben Levinson of Origins Recovery Centers, thanks very much for joining us on Intelligent Medicine.
Dr. Hoffman, it's a real privilege to be with you. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce, and so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via our convenient internet portal or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the Intelligent Medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or, alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening, and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.